from deep inside your audio device of choice.
I didn't start the show with ladies and gentlemen or with the word guys. I'm just no hooks now. I'm on my own. It's naked speech. I've noticed that a lot of people seem to want to hide away, get a break from this seemingly frantic flow of information. I think some so-called judges even have expressed that opinion. I've availed myself of that opportunity this week. When you're listening to this program, no matter how early on Sunday, I'm not there. I'm not here. I'm somewhere else, hanging with some music people. So this Valentine's Day weekend, pre-Valentine's Day weekend, this will be a show with music about love and some words about war. It's a neat little package. Hello, welcome to the show.
Say love's a mystery, and we think about it all the time. You can't ever force it, it's just something that you'll find. 'Cause for all your waiting, it's never where you thought it would be. Ooh. Say love's a mystery, and you're the mystery for me. I go to sleep at night when I hold you in my arms. I might sleep soundly, I might just wonder at your charms. How it ever came that one day you would find me. Love is a mystery, and that's the way it's been. Who can know where you find the flame? Your heart gets hurt, but you try again. Walk down that road till they come into you. Say love's a mystery, it takes patience, it takes time. Today we might quarrel, but tomorrow we'll be fine. 'Cause you make me smile, bring out the best in me. Love is a mystery, and you're the mystery for me. Yes, love is a mystery, and you're the mystery for me. Oh, la 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 la.
From London, this is Le Show. You may have noticed, I sure have, that the New York Times has started referring to Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, as a liar, and to the things he says occasionally, frequently, all the time, as lies. This began, interestingly enough, I think you'll find, right after he held his last news conference before this week, the one in the presidential campaign that was called to solve the problem once and for all of whether he thought President Obama was a natural-born citizen. You remember that news conference? The venue was the soon-to-be-opened Trump Hotel in Washington. CNN went live for about 30 minutes of an empty podium before he arrived. New York Times covered it with probably 20 reporters. He comes in, does a 10-minute talk about what a great hotel it's going to be, reads a two-sentence statement saying, yeah, well, of course he's a natural-born citizen. I never said he wasn't, and walks out without ever taking a question. It was after that that the New York Times and CNN started saying, liar. Little bit of a burn, they felt, I guess. Anyway, despite all that, The New York Times came up with an interesting piece of reporting last week, which sort of fell by the wayside, given all the rest of the noise. And it was simply recounting by President Trump's physician of the medications he's taking. He's taking a statin for his cholesterol. And of course, cholesterol no longer indicated by the federal government as dietary cholesterol, no longer related to blood cholesterol after 40 years of saying it was. A preparation to prevent rosacea, I guess because he doesn't want to get red spots in the orange. And most interestingly, Propecia, medication to prevent hair loss. And with us today, after too long an absence, I'm going to say, is Ralph the Talking Computer. Ralph, welcome back.
Thank you, Harry. Yeah. It has been too long. And of course, I'm talking about the time since I've been here, mm-hmm. but not anyone's particular endowment.
You haven't lost that sense of humor, Ralph, nor have you found it. You're here today because I called you, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. You called me to do you a favor, mm-hmm. and I said, I may run a little slowly with this older OS, but I'm not crazy.
Okay, well, some compensation changed hands, but you're here because I thought that the audience should know exactly what the side effects are of the hair loss medication, that the anti-hair loss medication that the president takes.
That's correct.
Okay.
And now that the funds have cleared, well, I'll be happy to read all of that for you.
Thank you.
And for your audience. Oh. Because, mm-hmm. after all, it's all about the love.
Wow. Is that artificial intelligence that makes you talk that way?
You know, in the computer world, we think human intelligence is the artificial one. By the way, I brought my own background music this time.
Okay, well, if you're so smart, play it.
Because today is your Valentine's show, this is Love is Blue.
Oh.
You'll see why shortly.
Okay.
The most common persistent side effects of Propecia are loss of libido, erectile dysfunction, depression, suicidal ideation, anxiety, panic attacks, Peyronie's disease, penile shrinkage, gynecomastia, muscle atrophy, cognitive impairment, insomnia, severely dry skin, and tinnitus. These can last for years after stopping the drug. Allergic reactions, including rash, itching, hives and swelling of the lips and face, breast enlargement and tenderness, depression, trouble having an orgasm, abnormal ejaculation, swelling in your hands or feet, dizziness, weakness, feeling like you might pass out, headache, runny nose, skin rash, testicular pain, male infertility or poor quality of semen,
poor quality,
male breast cancer.
Ugh.
In June 2011, the FDA released a safety announcement warning that Propecia may increase the risk for a serious form of prostate cancer. Known as high-grade prostate cancer, this is the most deadly kind.
It's ironic.
By April 2012, there were Propecia lawsuits against Merck, the maker of the drug, pending in 6 states, all related to persistent sexual dysfunction.
Wow. Ralph the Talking Computer, timing out almost perfectly with your music. Very good.
Thanks. That's how we do.
I would just say, you know, in putting myself in the president's mind for just a moment, it's probably worth it just for the swelling of the hands.
I just have to point out that I read side effects a lot these days.
Really?
It's kind of my keeping the power turned on gig, but normally I go much faster.
Yeah, I normally I hear side effects much faster. Just give us a taste of what that would sound like.
Breast enlargement, tenderness, depression, trouble having an orgasm, abnormal ejaculation, swelling in your hands or feet, swelling or tenderness in your breasts, dizziness, weakness, feeling like you might pass out.
All right. Now I feel like I've been told side effects. Ralph the Talking Computer, job well done.
I would be out of breath if I had breath.
I guess you would. And thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, Harry.
The show continues. This is the show, and a person might be excused watching what's been going on the last few years for thinking that we're trapped in a endlessly looping film regarding America's involvement in military adventures overseas. It seems, if you've been paying attention for a while, that the front end of these things sounds the same, and the back end of these things sounds the same, eerily so. And so I've invited to be on my show today a man who's been writing a series of books about the relationship of the American military to the American society, and has just come out with one which attempts to chronicle, in a historical context, the last 40 or so years of this nation's adventures in the greater Middle East. He's Professor Andrew Bacevich, formerly from Boston University, and now a full-time author. And as I say, America's War for the Greater Middle East is his military history is his latest book. In your new book, you draw some fairly profound lines between how this all started and where we've ended up. And you talk about the initiative by Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, his desire to draw the Soviets into Afghanistan. What was all that about? Why was he trying to draw the Soviets into Afghanistan?
Well, if I could provide just a little bit more context,
yeah,
in answering the question. So my new book purports to be a history, albeit a very preliminary history, a history of an event that's still unfolding, a history of a 3+ long decades American war in the greater Middle East, in the Islamic world. When that war began, and I date it from 1980 with the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine in January of that year, when it began, there was another war ongoing, and that was the Cold War, this contest between the United States and the Soviet Union, or the West and the Communist Bloc, centered on Europe, to see which of those two, politically, ideologically, would emerge triumphant. In the context of that war, in 1979, Brzezinski, then the National Security Advisor to President Carter, Brzezinski and members of his staff came up with what they thought was a brilliant idea. And the brilliant idea was to suck the Soviet Union into an Afghanistan intervention that Brzezinski and his colleagues hoped would become, for the Soviets, their equivalent of Vietnam. And indeed that occurred. And viewed in the context of the Cold War, this Afghanistan war that we promoted was a great success. Because clearly, in retrospect, that was one of the things that ended up bringing the Soviet Union down. The problem is that at that same time, the war for the greater Middle East was beginning, and the intervention in Afghanistan that we helped to promote and that we then fueled with billions of dollars of weapons turned out to be a catastrophe for all involved.
How exactly did Brzezinski propose to suck the Soviets into Afghanistan? What was the tactic?
To provide support, to get to the sort of the rubber where the rubber meets the road, mm-hmm. to provide weapons to Afghan militants who were opposed to the intrusion of the Soviet Union into Afghan affairs. By December of 1979, that resulted in this effort to lure in the Soviets. December of 1979, the Soviets invaded and occupied Afghanistan and then spent the next decade trying to pacify Afghanistan, much as we have spent the last, 17 years or 16 years trying to pacify Afghanistan. So we lured in the Soviets, and the Soviets paid dearly. A Cold War victory, but in the context of the war for the greater Middle East, really the beginning of a line of great sorrows for which we must hold ourselves responsible.
You quote Ronald Reagan as calling the insurgents in Afghanistan, quote, noble savages in some sort of a state of purity fighting for an abstract idea of freedom.
They weren't fighting for an abstract idea of freedom. They were fighting for precisely the same reason that the Taliban has been resisting the United States for these many years, and that is to get outsiders out so that Afghans can be responsible for running their own society the way they want to, granted that the way they want to run Afghan society is at very radically at odds with what we would view as enlightened values.
And I think many of us know that one of the people involved in mobilizing the Afghan insurgency was a gentleman by the name of Osama bin Laden.
Who, when the Soviets ultimately withdrew in 1989, came to the conclusion that waging jihad against outside so-called great powers could end in victory. So to some considerable extent, the jihadist success against the Soviets in Afghanistan persuaded them that they could enjoy success against other powers. Now, to quickly go to the next sort of phase of the story as it unfolds, is it during the 1980s, at the same time that we're opposing the Soviets in Afghanistan, we are supporting the dictator who governs Iraq, a guy named Saddam Hussein.
Heard of him.
Americans have totally forgotten the fact that from 1980 to 1988, an immense, destructive, murderous war between Iran and Iraq filled that decade. A war begun by Saddam Hussein as a war of aggression. And Americans might think, well, gosh, Saddam, we've always known Saddam Hussein's a bad guy. Maybe so, but the Reagan administration supported Saddam indirectly and directly to the point that we were engaged in what is yet another forgotten war, a shooting war with Iran in the latter part of the 1980s. Well, that war finally ends. It ends with Saddam out of money, but not out of ambition. And virtually as soon as the Iran-Iraq war ends, he decides to go invade Kuwait. It happens in August of 1990. We respond. Suddenly now Saddam is our enemy. We liberate Kuwait. But unfortunately, that war, what I call the second Gulf War, the first one being 1980 to 1988, the second Gulf War seems to end in a decisive victory that turns out not to be decisive. It's not decisive because Saddam Hussein survives. And so the United States then, after 1991, nobody in the United States is paying attention, begins to garrison on a permanent basis the Persian Gulf to include specifically maintaining substantial U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia, the land of the two holy places. So here we have, from bin Laden's perspective, infidels occupying this sacred space, And that presence of the United States aimed at containing Saddam now becomes one of the major sources of inspiring al-Qaeda and setting in train the sequence of events that, of course, leads to 9/11. It's an immense amount of blundering caused by many things, but caused in particular by an absence of clarity on the part of U.S. policymakers about what they were trying to do and who they were up against.
You draw this back to the beginning of the 1980s and the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine, that when the U.S. began garrisoning large amounts of military personnel and equipment in Saudi Arabia, this was the culmination of the Carter Doctrine. What was the Carter Doctrine?
Well, again, just to give a little bit more historical context here, if we look at the post-war period, the Cold War, the U.S. has chosen, for the first time in its history, after 1945, to maintain on a permanent basis very substantial military power. We choose to become a military superpower. But in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, the focus of strategic attention is on the defense of Western Europe and the defense of East Asia. Those are the two places that we're willing to fight. During that entire period of time, minimal U.S. presence anywhere in the Islamic world, because we don't care that much about the Persian Gulf, Central Asia, and the like. That changes in 1979 as a result of two events. The first event is the overthrow of the Shah, and the second event is the one I already alluded to, which was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Those two put together then inspire Jimmy Carter, who in January of 1980, desperately hoping to win a second term, but being viewed as a weak and ineffective president, inspire him in January of 1980 to promulgate the Carter Doctrine, which is a specific statement that now defines the Persian Gulf as a vital U.S. national security interest. And what that means is that's a place we are willing to fight for, just as we were then willing to fight for Western Europe or fight for Korea and Japan. So that statement then puts in motion what becomes a process of militarizing U.S. policy. Step by step, larger presence, greater willingness to intervene in conflicts, large and small, brief and protracted, leading us up to where we are today, which I think, and many people, I think, define as, in essence, a state of permanent war. War has become a normal condition. Nobody expects that the war in which we are engaged, whatever you want to call it, if you don't want to call it the war for the greater Middle East, nobody expects that that war is going to end anytime soon. Indeed, I would argue that nobody in Washington has a clue about how to end that war.
Jimmy Carter didn't just put on a blindfold and poke at the Persian Gulf with a pin out of sheer randomness. That had followed the oil shock of the early 1970s,
yes.
Right? And this was a purported response to that.
It was. And one of the tragic elements of this story is that Carter himself did not wish to embark upon this military course of action. It's a very famous speech worth reading that he made in the summer of 1979. It's called his Malaise speech. It's an utterly inappropriate name to stick to it. But Carter goes on national TV, and in the context of this real concern about the American way of life somehow being threatened because we no longer have guaranteed access to plentiful supplies of oil, he goes on national television. He says, "My fellow Americans, maybe the problem here is not that we don't have enough oil. Maybe the problem here is that we have bought into what is a false understanding of freedom. We've gone down the wrong path. We've become selfish. We've become materialistic. We have forfeited the values that, in his opinion, initially made America great." And so what Carter was saying is, let's take on this challenge of an energy shortage by changing the way we live. Let's opt for virtue rather than for selfishness and materialism. Of course, I mean, this had no appeal to the American people.
Doesn't even sound good to me now.
Well, you're right. You know, here, I got a good idea. I want you to sacrifice.
Yeah.
And Americans are not, we don't look to our politicians to say, call on us to sacrifice, except in some certain circumstances like World War II. We want the politicians to say there's going to be more tomorrow. And so Carter's attempt to avoid going down this path was derided. And I think basically the Carter Doctrine speech of January 1980 was a concession of defeat on his part. The only way he thought he might have a chance to beat Reagan in the upcoming election was to get tough. And so there's no doubt in my mind that Carter had zero understanding of exactly what was going to evolve over the following decades, but he let loose the dogs of war.
Just as a historical footnote, the U.S. did have one moment when it took some interest in the Persian Gulf area prior to then, because the CIA overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953. Right?
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, I overstated the point saying we didn't care.
Yeah.
We didn't care enough to have that be a place that we were going to invest military power in. Doesn't mean that we were not involved in various sundry shenanigans. And of course, the episode you cite also ends up being an element in the narrative as it unfolds, because the Iranian Revolution of 1979, from the point of view of the Iranian revolutionaries, was inspired in some respects by their not only their desire to get rid of the Shah, but their determination to get rid of the American presence in Iran and influence in Iran, which they perceived, whatever we think, what they perceived to be utterly nefarious. So, yes, that's also part of the story.
Yeah, and another footnote, while the United States was supporting, and you point this out in your book, while the United States was supporting Saddam during the Iran-Iraq War, it somewhat incoherently was also selling arms to Iran.
Well, not only somewhat incoherently, utterly incoherently. But I mean, the reason that's important to remember that, I think, is that is a prime illustration of the absence of any strategic clarity with regard to purpose. I think one of the reasons I might have a hard time selling this idea of a war for the greater Middle East and that links a whole laundry list of military enterprises, one of the reasons I'll have a hard time is because people have become accustomed to simply seeing every one of these episodes as kind of a standalone proposition, whether it's peacekeepers in Lebanon or bombing Libya or humanitarian intervention in Somalia or going back time and again to Iraq, Afghanistan, where we have become conditioned to think of them as distinct episodes. The key argument I'm trying to make in the book is that only when we acknowledge that they are part of a larger enterprise can we then assess the extent of our failure. And when you cite things like the Iran-Contra affair, where Ronald Reagan is illegally providing weapons to the Iranians, who, while they're calling us the great Satan, at the same time that we're supporting Saddam Hussein against Iran, that's a classic illustration of the absence of any clear thinking by the people in Washington.
Or is it Metternichian balance of power taken to an ultimate extreme?
Gosh, if it were that, even, I mean, I might say, isn't that terribly cynical? But I don't, their thinking did not rise to the level of sophistication that invites a comparison with Metternich.
Okay. I was just floating that as a trial balloon. Mm-hmm. You sum up the history of what you call the first Gulf War by saying it began with a mix of cynicism and betrayal. It ended with an atrocity. Can you just briefly fill us in on what those two incidents were that bookended the Iran-Iraq War from the United States perspective?
Well, we began to support Saddam Hussein against Iran as soon as it became apparent that Saddam's expectations of a quick, easy victory weren't going to pan out. And within the Reagan administration, there was great fear that Iran indeed might emerge triumphant and therefore dominant in the Persian Gulf. So we began tilt in favor of Iraq in a variety of ways, initially providing intelligence, providing so-called dual-use technologies, turning a blind eye when Saddam went shopping for weapons throughout the West, letting all that happen. But the key episode that then begins to engage us directly military was when Saddam Hussein's military, his Air Force, attacked the USS Stark. We had begun to have a larger naval presence in the Persian Gulf as the Iran-Iraq War evolved. Saddam's Air Force hits a U.S. warship with two Exocet missiles, kills a bunch of Americans, wounds a bunch of Americans, cripples the ship. And within 24 hours, the Reagan administration blames Iran for this Iraqi attack. And so the Iraqi attack on the Stark becomes the pretext for beginning a small but not insignificant maritime campaign against Iran. Basically, the aim of the campaign was to make it difficult for Iran to interfere with shipping of oil in the Persian Gulf, which would, of course, then benefit Iraq. So that campaign is a tactical success. I mean, our Navy against the Iranian Navy, not exactly much of a contest. Mm-hmm. But then it culminates in the second atrocity that a U.S. naval warship, the USS Vincennes, shoots down an Iranian Airbus, killing all crew and passengers aboard.
Civilians.
Absolutely civilians. This is a civilian commercial airliner on a planned civilian route with an approved flight plan. The American authorities lie, claiming that the airplane was descending in the direction of the warship when, in fact, it was gaining in altitude, claiming that it had violated the flight plan, and claiming also that the American warship was in international waters when, in fact, the warship was within Iranian territorial waters. So that it was an atrocity. We didn't apologize. And of course, we Americans have tended to forget this episode, which happened way back in the 1980s. But from a point of view of understanding the historical evolution of this entire chapter, maybe we ought to recognize that the Iranians haven't forgot, that the Iranians have grudges against us just as we have grudges against them, for example, with regard to the hostage crisis.
Just to finish up with the 1980s, there was the incident of the U.S. Marines in Lebanon that you alluded to a moment ago. How did that fit into all of this?
Well, mine is a military narrative. That is to say, it's a military history. It's a history of unfolding military events. And the first such event, really, is the hostage rescue mission undertaken by Carter in April 1980, which, of course, ended in complete failure. Indeed, the failure occurred even before the plan itself unfolded. When Reagan became president, in the wake of an Israeli invasion of Lebanon, 1982, that utterly destabilized Lebanon, the Reagan administration decided that the United States had an interest in trying to restore peace and stability. And to do that, they sent basically a reinforced battalion of Marines to be, quote unquote, peacekeepers, with the initial notion that the American presence in and of itself would sufficiently diffuse things, ensure the separation of Israeli and Lebanese PLO forces, that things would calm down. That turned out not to be the case. And indeed, the longer the Marines stayed, the more they were actually drawn into this, what was both a Lebanese civil war and an Israeli occupation, were drawn into it as combatants. And that then created the circumstances which culminated in the October 1983 terrorist attack on the Marine compound that killed, I think it was 214 Americans. Reagan thereafter saying, it's time for us to get the hell out of Dodge. The significance, I think, of that in the context of the larger story is, mm-hmm. once again, what's the purpose? What are we trying to do? There was no clear understanding of what we were trying to do that made any sense in with regard to the specifics that existed on the ground. And the second thing that matters is that whether Reagan supporters want to admit it or not, In the aftermath of the bombing, he cut and run. And that sends a signal to our adversaries. You know, if you're going to go in, and then at first time you take some serious losses, you're going to say, well, I'm out of here. Whether you like it or not, you're sending signals to people like Osama bin Laden or other militants that suggest that the United States doesn't have real staying power.
In answer to the question, what the heck were we doing this for, which could be asked about so many of these military ventures that we've been involved in the greater Middle East, we go back to the Carter Doctrine, which was a reaction to the oil embargo. And your analysis is that most of this stuff was, at least in the instant, designed to preserve access to the oil of the Middle East via the free passage through the Persian Gulf.
Well, you know, it was in an immediate and concrete sense. That is to say, at the outset, the war for the greater Middle East was a war for oil. But my argument is that even from the outset, if not clearly articulated, it was about much more. It was about affirming our self-image as the dominant power in the world, not simply dominant in a military sense, but dominant in an ideological sense. There is a deep-seated, this is the part of American exceptionalism. There's a deep-seated conviction, certainly widely held in our political establishment, but also widely held among ordinary Americans, that we define the future of humankind. That our values, our arrangements, our institutions, whether we can call it democracy using kind of a shorthand term, but it's much more than that. The American way of life determines the way the world is going. And events in 1979, citing the Iranian Revolution as a good example, but a multitude of events since, particularly in the Islamic world, challenge that notion that we define the future. And I think psychologically, there's an enormous reluctance on the part of Americans, and again, I would emphasize, particularly Americans in the political establishment, to give up this claim to our specialness, our chosenness. There's a great reluctance to take on board the possibility that while we certainly are a great power, that maybe we are simply one nation among many in the long course of history. And so many of the efforts centered, and I think this is in spades true after 9/11, when George W. Bush is president and it immediately responds to the 9/11 attacks by saying on national television, look, we have faced this kind of adversary before. This is the equivalent of the hateful ideologies of the 20th century. This is Nazism. This is communism. And just as we destroyed those challenges, we will destroy this one. That is to say, we will demonstrate through the use of military power that we define the future. And I think at root, that really has been one of the driving considerations in this entire enterprise, to affirm, to validate American exceptionalism. And unfortunately, very few of the military outcomes that we have been able to achieve support that notion. I mean, at the present moment, where we look at Iraq, I mean, in my narrative, we're now in the fourth Gulf War. You know, the first one was 80 to 88. The second Gulf War was going after Saddam with Desert Storm. The third Gulf War was the war of 2003 to 2011. Lo and behold, here we are again, once again involved in another Gulf War that may or may not end in success operationally. But when you take those four Gulf Wars together, it sure the heck doesn't look like we're making a lot of progress in bringing harmony or democracy or even order to that place, which really is the focal point or the nexus of the war for the greater Middle East going back to 1980.
It seems that up till 9/11, the priority for the United States in addressing the greater Middle East was stability. And then following 9/11 and the assumption of power by the people around George W. Bush, the idea became to transform this area. There were speeches made in which Bush explicitly denounced the preservation of stability as a worthwhile goal.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is tremendously important. I mean, there are, you know, Bush is a very divisive figure in the eyes of many Americans, and I believe that there will be many of our fellow citizens who would dismiss Bush's freedom and democracy rhetoric, his so-called freedom agenda, as completely, totally cynical. I don't believe that's true. I believe that Bush, who prior to 9/11 had advertised himself as a realist who is in favor of what he called a humble foreign policy, that he underwent that 9/11 was a transformative experience. And as a genuinely religious person, and we're getting here into, like, you know, psychologizing, but as a genuinely religious person, I think he turned back to matters of faith to help him understand what had occurred and what he should do next. And that found expression in Bush becoming a new Woodrow Wilson. I mean, somebody who now articulated, and if you read his speeches, I mean, they're, in many respects, they're quite eloquent. United States as the agent to bring freedom to the oppressed. Now, United States as a country that would no longer give the Islamic world a pass on things like democratic practice and rights for women. So he was persuaded that he was called upon to undertake this transformative mission. And unfortunately, he and those around him, people like Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, they were also persuaded that American military supremacy was unchallengeable, that we possessed the military capability to bring about this kind of political, ideological, and cultural transformation. And that's what the third Gulf War, the Gulf War of 2003-2011, was all about. That was their attempt to validate this, what American military supremacy properly employed could do. They thought it was going to be an easy win. They thought it was going to be quick. They thought that making Iraq into some kind of a functioning liberal democracy was going to happen rather quickly, and they were utterly, totally, and completely wrong. So instead of a short, victorious war, we ended up with an immensely long, costly war that created havoc in its wake.
Following up on that, there is still a lively debate in this country about the role of the surge and whether I talked at the beginning about how we keep hearing these echoes, and at the end of the Vietnam War, proponents of the war had a theory that we could have won it if we hadn't been fighting with one of our hands tied behind our back.
Right.
And we hear it again about the surge won the war, and then we withdrew, and all the place went to hell.
That's right. Obama gave away the victory.
Yeah.
Is the argument, which, right, I think is utterly, totally bogus.
So what was the surge, and what was its effect?
Two points about the surge. And the first one is to appreciate the extent to which when Bush embarked upon the surge, which he didn't remember, he fired Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
He fired the architect of what was supposed to be the War of Liberation. And he replaced the then commander in Iraq, General Casey, with General Petraeus. Those changes alone showed that Bush was, in effect, abandoning the expectations that had informed the Iraq War in the first place. That is to say, the freedom agenda, so-called freedom agenda, was now defunct. And that needs to be understood. The second point about the surge is what it did was to, and this is not a trivial achievement, what it did was to very substantially reduce the level of violence, which it did in part by the shrewd application of counterinsurgency methods, did in part because the additional presence of U.S. forces who undertook an exceedingly difficult task and did well. Probably most significant was the so-called Sunni awakening, that is to say, that we paid for Sunnis to put down their arms or even come down to our side because the Sunnis, for their own reasons, had decided that they did not wish to see al-Qaeda in Iraq prevail in their country. So for all these reasons put together, the level of violence is reduced appreciably. But, and here's the point to emphasize, the insurgency had not been defeated. The insurgency continued. There was no conclusive victory. And so once the withdrawal occurred, and let us remember that Bush himself had committed his administration to that withdrawal, simply that Obama followed through, once the U.S. withdrew, that created conditions for the insurgency then to erupt once again and put us on the path to where we are. So the notion that, you know, the surge is some kind of a victory that should stand alongside Gettysburg or Normandy is utterly absurd.
There's a moment where you point out what is fairly well known now, that 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. And you say that the Bush administration treated that question as off limits. It seems to me you're suggesting more than you say there.
Well, I don't mean to be. I mean, maybe I am. But
well, there are other people. There are other people who would take that a lot farther. Let's put it that way.
Okay. I am suggesting that the rather lazy assumption that the Saudis are our friends, that these are allies, this is a nation with whom we share values in common, is misleading.
What about interests in common?
Well, let's crank back to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got interests in common, and the interest in common is they want to keep pumping oil. And given our energy situation at that point, the Americans keep wanting importing that oil so we can put it in our cars so the American way of life won't be compromised. But now let's fast forward to 2016. Well, the energy situation has radically changed. I mean, many of us, me included, would certainly like to see us begin to move to a, you know, post-carbon-based fuels economy. But we haven't in particular gone that far. We still need oil. We still want our cars. We still don't want to make any of the sacrifices Jimmy Carter called upon us to make. But guess what? We don't need Saudi oil anymore. We are, for all practical purposes, energy self-sufficient, relying on sources within the Western Hemisphere. So if there's a place worth fighting for, there's a place where we should be willing to send Americans to die on behalf of energy security, then we should be sending them to Canada or to Venezuela, where probably we'd have better luck, rather than maintain this notion that dates back to 1980 that somehow the American way of life is intimately tied to our access to Saudi oil. Now, let me emphasize, that doesn't mean that Saudi oil is globally unimportant. It is globally important. It's important to Europe. It's important to the Japanese. But quite frankly, if it's important to the Europeans, then let's let the Europeans start to pony up with a little bit of a larger commitment to maintaining security in the region rather than outsourcing it to the United States, which as a practical matter, what's been happening. Now, if I was a European, I'd be happy for the rules of the game as they have evolved to continue. But I'm not a European. And I think in many respects, we're getting our pocket picked.
I don't think there are going to be such a thing as Europeans very much longer, but that's just
Well, that could be too.
going back to this, as we come to near the end of this conversation, the recurring themes through this whole adventure, and you keep pointing out at various junctures the degree to which American policymakers and decision makers and military decision makers seem to be oblivious to issues of faith and history in the area of the greater Middle East.
Well, I mean, you know, I could cite myself as an example. Back in 1980, when this had, I was an Army officer at the time, my world was defined by the Cold War. Militarily, my focal point was on the possibility of a war with the Soviet Union. Didn't think about unconventional war, certainly didn't think about the possibility of war in the Islamic world, and quite frankly, didn't think about what that world was all about, how what we call the modern Middle East came into existence at the end of World War I as a function of reckless European imperialists who thought they could carve up the Ottoman Empire to suit themselves. My knowledge of Islam, which today is not great, was for all practical purposes non-existent back in 1980. And I have to say that I doubt if my ignorance was that much less than the ignorance of people sitting around the National Security Council advising President Carter and then President Reagan and so on about what we ought to do. So that has been a huge historical blindside. I mean, I think it was Ambrose Bierce, I think, who once said that that war is what the United States uses as the vehicle to learn about the rest of the world, and certainly as a consequence of the various military interventions, large and small, since 1980, we've now become to learn a lot about the geography, about the people, about the religion, the culture, the history, and you know, it makes you want to weep that we didn't have that kind of an understanding of the region back when we began this enterprise.
But isn't this the ultimate echo of Vietnam? We learned during the Vietnam era when we had these teach-ins where people who, academics basically, who were expert in Southeast Asia and its history, pointed out that the version of Vietnam's role in the Cold War as being a pawn of China was at odds with the actual history of the movement as a nationalist movement fighting against French colonialism, and that we were basically the inheritors of the French colonials, not of the side of freedom, and we're equally, or the policymakers you suggest are equally ignorant about our role in taking over the British colonial role in the Middle East.
There's no question about it. I've long thought that, you know, we Americans continue to have this sentimental attitude with regard to Great Britain that I think somehow is traceable to these ancient memories of Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt standing arm in arm facing down the Nazis. But I think there's a great book to be written that really explains the contribution that Britain has made to creating such a gal-dang mess in the world that is the direct consequence both of British imperialism, but also of British decline. You know, when they had enough of India, they walked away from India. When they had enough of the Palestine mandate, they walked away from that part of the world. And the consequences have not been pretty. Now, I don't want to overstate that. It's not like Britain is responsible for all the world's ills. But there is a story that is complex, and the habit that many Americans have of wanting to see history as a morally uplifting tale simply doesn't get us very far with regard to that part of the world.
I have the name for that book: The Great Skedaddle.
That is exactly right. The Great Skedaddle.
Andrew Bacevich, author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, Military History, and previously A Breach of Trust. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Oh, thank you.
An hour of music about love and talking about war, ladies and gentlemen. That's this edition of Le Show. It comes to you again next week at the same time over these same stations. My thanks for engineering help on today's broadcast to Paul Kahlo at WBUR Boston, where this program is not heard, and Mike Gilbert at Swell Tone in New Orleans, which no longer exists. The interview, you may recall, was originally broadcast April of 2016. Just everything changes all the time, except my underwear. Ladies and gentlemen, the email address for this program, playlist of the music heard on this program, and your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts. Too late for Valentine's Day, but St. Patrick's Day? What do you think? All at harryshearer.com. And me? Yes, I'm on Twitter. At the Harry Shearer. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. Next week, diving right back into the swirl, the flow, the live. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from chilly London town.